What was the Star of Bethlehem? Was it a planet like Jupiter or Venus? Was it a conjunction of planets? Perhaps a conjunction of Jupiter with Venus? Was it a supernova? An exploding star far away in space that suddenly appeared brighter than would normally be the case? Or was it a comet? One of those mysterious balls of ice that come from the outer reaches of the solar system and comes round the sun? Or perhaps it wasn't any of those, because this star did some strange things. It seemed to appear, so that the wise men saw it when they were in the east, and it seemed to disappear. And then it reappeared again, so that it led the wise men from Jerusalem to Bethlehem. How can a star lead people from one place to the other? And how could a star settle over a house pointing out where Jesus lay? Hi, my name is Paul Taylor, and I find these facts about this star so interesting that I've written an entire little book about them. Find out more about Bethlehem's Star by buying this book, a Christmas book for all year round, available from Amazon or from allaboutbooks.store or anywhere where good books are sold.
And if you're saying that you know truth, if you're saying that you know what is truth, then you've got to have something to actually measure that against.
Paul Taylor Podcast.
25 feet, 1,000 layers. How many millions of years did that take to form then? The answer is it took 3 hours.
Paul Taylor Podcast.
This is the Paul Taylor Podcast, written, presented and produced by me, Paul Taylor, through Proverbs 18:10 Media. You can find out more information, including the RSS feeds necessary for your favorite podcast software, at proverbs1810.org. I hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, and welcome to episode 38 of the Proverbs 18:10 podcast. My name is Paul Taylor. You're very welcome here. Thank you for joining me. This is the podcast that I used to be calling the Paul Taylor Podcast. I've changed its name so that it doesn't concentrate on my name, but concentrates on the purpose. Proverbs 18:10, if you go and look it up, talks about the name of the Lord being a strong tower, and the righteous run into it and they're safe. And it's really a good label to use for the a podcast that's dealing with basic stuff, with apologetics and with our foundations in the book of Genesis. And that's what we're looking at in this particular podcast. By the way, let me just, as an aside, tell you a little bit about my other podcasts. I do have a number of other podcasts that are available. Just looking at my website here, I'll tell you about the latest editions of all of them. On Mondays, there's a podcast called Tech Right. This is a technology podcast. It's short pieces of information. I don't want to go and give you loads and loads of bits of stuff on technology. There's one short thing, so it's about between 10 and 20 minutes. And I'm trying to explain then about different technologies, particularly information technology. That's what I'm most interested in. This week's episode is about encrypted mail systems. So you'll find that podcast on the website Proverbs 18:10 Media, which is proverbs1810.org. On Saturdays, I do a podcast called My World. This is the only one of my podcasts which is behind a paywall. You'll find a free teaser for it on the website. Saturdays, for example, was on about Bonfire Night, about all the celebrations that go on in Britain on November the 5th, trying to explain a little bit about those and what fun they can be. So that is the My World podcast, but you only get the full podcast if you're a subscriber at subscribestar.com/Paul F. Taylor. Please go there, because it's my means of paying for my time for these podcasts and for the writing of my books. on Fridays, going backwards in time, I have the In the Car podcast, which is generally my sort of rants and comments on political things and other issues. So that's on Fridays. Last Friday's was about Bethlehem. So that's In the Car on Fridays. Usually recorded in the car, but not always. On Thursdays, I have a podcast which is called Words from the Tower. That is a short podcast. The idea is that those podcasts are about 2 minutes long. They're available for you to download and use in the middle of your own podcast as fillers, you know, if you want to break away for something. So permission to use those podcasts is granted under a Creative Commons license. So that's what you got on Thursday. On Wednesdays, I have my podcast called What Next? This is about eschatology and about the end times. So that was on Wednesday. The latest episode is about the Abrahamic Covenant. So there we go. That fills in all the various bits and pieces that I do during the week. I don't think I've forgotten anything there. I think I've got them all out there. So again, as I just mentioned earlier, if you want to support these podcasts, then please head over to subscribestar.com/Paul F. Taylor. Well, Genesis chapter 12 is pivotal. It's very, very important. The first part of Genesis chapter 12 is, I've often said, you can't really understand unless you've believed the first 11 chapters of Genesis to be literally historically true. And it's the bridge to the rest of Genesis. Genesis is not two books, it's just one book. And it's why when I was doing my commentary and realizing I was going to have to split it into more than one volume, I chose not to split it at the end of Genesis 11, which is where most people do. I split instead at the end of Genesis 9, because volume 2 is about the preparation of everything going in towards Abraham and all about the life of Abraham and the activities concerned. So you might wonder why we've got this account, you know, why, given that Abraham's only just come into the land of Canaan, that he's been told to go to, he's been ordered to go to, and he's been promised the land for his offspring forever. Why it is, then, that he goes to Egypt. And it's to do with a particular flaw in Abraham's character that we'll see over and over again. It's important to understand the flaws. Abraham improved during his life. He matured during his life. And I've tried to explain to you that he was really a relatively young man at this point. You know, he's 75 years old. Oh, yes, that's that really young? Well, it was then, because he wasn't going to die until 175. So I've tried to point out that he was really the equivalent of someone around about 35. So maturation would take time. And we've got to understand things in that context. Abraham is like a man of 35. His wife Sarah is like a young lady of 30, even though she's 65 years old. Okay, so it's important to see them in that context. So where have we got to so far? Well, Abraham's come into the land, and I concentrated last week on the issue of the covenant that God made with Abraham, a covenant that's going to be reiterated a few times as Abraham matures and is more able to understand things. And of course, the covenant also reiterated with Isaac and with Jacob. And I tried to explain a little bit about why that's the case, why this covenant has to be given more than once, even though it comes into effect. And I'll show you it comes into effect in Genesis chapter 12. And in fact, the events of Genesis chapter 12 are to prove that the covenant has come into place, even dealing with an imperfect person. Because remember, the covenant doesn't depend on Abraham. We'll see that very, very strongly when we come to Genesis 15. But the covenant does not depend on Abraham. It depends on God. God is the one who made the covenant. Covenant is just offered. You don't have the opportunity to negotiate a covenant, unlike a contract. So that's where we go. So what we've got is Abraham has departed Haran. He's come to the land of Canaan, and he passes through the land to the place at Shechem, to the Oak of Moreh. Okay, now oaks in that particular part of the world, as in other parts of the world, quite often used for pagan worship, and I think that's quite important. Abraham is claiming this land for God, and of course he's going to be a nomad. We have to remember he's come from a civilization where they had really good quality housing with central heating, flushing toilets. It's a very advanced civilization as we know now, and he's come to live in Canaan, to live in tents, where of course he would not have flushing toilets. He's got to get used to that, how that works. And it's a very, very different sort of land that he's in. We're reminded that the Canaanites are in the land, and so that brings us back to remembering what happened in Genesis chapter 9, that we've got that prophetic curse, if you like. Cursed be Canaan, not Ham. It wasn't Ham that was cursed, it was Ham made a mistake, but it's Canaan. At the same time, God is prophesying that the Canaanites are going to be a people who completely reject the Lord. Now, that's as a people. There are individual Canaanites who are different, and there are people from that lineage who were, you know, even in Jesus's line of descent. Because, of course, if you come to know the Lord in faith, as, for example, Rahab did, then you're part of God's people. And that's important. So she could be counted as God's people, just as Ruth could later when she says, your people will be my people, your God will be my God. Now, God has appeared to Abraham and he said, to your offspring I will give this land. So he's reiterating what he just promised at the beginning of chapter 12. And so after that, in verse 8, we read that Abraham's moved to the hill country east of Bethel and pitched his tent, with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. He's not going into the cities themselves, which are ruled by Canaanites, but he's there in the land. He's moved from the Oak of Moreh. He's moved somewhere else. Why? Simply because he's taking possession. Of course, he never owned any of it apart from the field and the cave where he buried Sarah later on. But he never, other than that, owned any part of the land. But nevertheless, he's claiming it, understanding that this is for his descendants forever, even though he doesn't have any descendants at the moment, and the situation seems hopeless because Sarah is barren. By the way, let's reiterate again that Sarah is the equivalent of a 30-year-old woman. She is within childbearing years, but all these years she hasn't born any children. You know, they're married, there's no children being produced, and yet she is within childbearing years, which suggests that she is medically barren. As I said, we people often think, well, she's 65, she can't have children. Yeah, but how did she get to that age? In any case, even if you thought that that's the equivalent of a 65-year-old today, how did she get to that age without having children? There's a medical issue here, and but as I said, she could have still born children at this age had there not been this problem. There's a barrenness there, and it's because God is going to work a miracle. In fact, God makes her wait until she is actually too old to have children, but that's what happens. Now, going on in verse 8, the second half of verse 8, we've got that Abraham builds an altar, he calls on the name of the Lord, and then it says Abraham journeyed on, still going toward the Negev, which is the desert. And again, he is taking over the land, he's taking possession, he's worshipping God in different places, because all this land is God's, and it's what God has given to him. For his descendants, even though, as I said, he never sees any of it other than that one field. So that brings us then to the fact that they went to Egypt. They sojourned to Egypt. Now, what was all that about? We're clearly taught that this is a mistake. We know that this is a mistake on Abram's part. It's a sin, if you like. It is a sin, and we'll see why, what the sin is to do there. Well, the sin begins with Abram going down to Egypt to sojourn there. Now, obviously, he didn't intend to stay long. Sojourn implies he wasn't going to stay there for a long time, but he's gone to Egypt to sojourn there. Why? Because the famine is severe in the land. So what's he doing there? Why has he gone there? Well, the famine is there, and I think the famine is very much a test of where God, of course, knew what the answer was going to be, and God has decreed this, but there is a test. Abraham will need to look back on this and see this as an error, even though he goes and makes the same sin again later. And this is interesting, and it's pertinent, because that's the way that you and I behave. Well, maybe I should just talk to myself. It's the way I behave. There are sins that I've committed where I've committed them more than once. And, you know, we often say to ourselves, well, I've learned my lesson. I'm never doing that again. And actually, that's not the case quite very often. We will do a repeated sin. And God is merciful, because God doesn't throw Abraham off at this point at all. God continues to work through him, and God makes him more mature, so that, you know, the bit that I'm writing in my commentary at the moment is on Genesis 24, where Abraham takes a completely mature and faithful decision. And is completely faithful in the way that he gives his instructions to his servant and how to go and get a wife for Isaac, his son. So there's been a huge amount has been learned by Abraham in that time. Maybe you might say, well, he's learned it very slowly. Well, in a sense, it doesn't matter. He has learned it. So here he's been told he's got to go to Canaan. He knew that it was not going to be a picnic. He knew that it was not going to be comfortable, because he was leaving comfort. He knew what comfort was, and he's been living in the land in tents. And I'm not quite sure how long he would have been living in the land in tents, but there's a problem now. There's a famine. Surely he should have had the faith to stay, because that's where God has placed him. But the famine's severe, so he decides to go to Egypt, because he's heard there is food. Now, surely this should make us start to think about what's going to happen later when Jacob and his sons all go to Egypt. Joseph has been taken away to Egypt. So there's an introduction to Egypt. Of course, that was God's decree. They were being obedient in going to Egypt there. But there was a famine then that drove them to Egypt. Here's a famine that drove Abraham to Egypt out of sin. But God is still preparing the way, and that's important to note. Abraham, we've talked about as being typological, is a real historical character and an allegory at the same time. That's really the best way I can describe a typology. God is performing many prophetic actions through Abraham's life. Hopefully I don't need to remind you about the scene of sacrifice, Abraham sacrificing Isaac, and we know that there's a pattern there, and we'll study that in far more detail when we get to that chapter, the pattern there of the Father sacrificing the Son, God the Father sacrificing God the Son. It's a pattern there that teaches us about that. And of course, we learn about the resurrection at that point and so on. There's a huge amount that God is revealing through the circumstances in which Abraham is put. And here's a prophecy, in a sense, through his actions, that he's going to Egypt and he will have to come out of Egypt. And that's very important. The idea of being out of Egypt, that's something that the Israelites would talk about for a long while. Talking about the God who brought them out of Egypt. And even the prophecy of the Saviour, where we read, out of Egypt I called my son. Of course, we read from Matthew's Gospel that Joseph and Mary and Jesus had to go to Egypt after when the killing of the innocents was going on, Herod killing the innocents, and they went to Egypt as refugees and then eventually came back. So this going to Egypt and coming out of Egypt is a very important theme in the Bible. Now, when I say these sort of things, I'm not casting doubt. I'm not saying this is allegorical. Far from it. This is real history. But I'm saying that God is using this history, these circumstances, as only God can do, to be able to teach important lessons and show prophetically what is going to happen. So, they're going to Egypt. When they're about to enter Egypt, you know, they've sinned in going to Egypt in the first place, but they're about to enter Egypt, and he says to Sarah, his wife, I know you are a woman beautiful in appearance. Now, by the way, that also suggests that Sarah is not like a modern 65-year-old. You know, you could say that a 65-year-old woman could be attractive, could be handsome, could be majestic, but not the sort of person who necessarily would be stolen away to someone taking them as a wife or as a concubine. So clearly, Sarah is youthful in appearance, as she would be if she was the equivalent of a 30-year-old today. She's beautiful, she's attractive, and that's what they're saying. So Abraham continues, I know that you're a woman beautiful in appearance. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife. Then they will kill me, but they will let you live. Because in order to steal Sarah away, they would have to kill Abraham. Now, in a sense, Abraham is partly faithful here, and isn't this the way a lot of sins could turn out? We listen to God partly, and then we try and do God's work for him without following his instructions. It's not that we should sit back and do nothing. Please don't get me wrong. You know, when we see Abraham sending his servant to get a wife for Isaac, we see Abraham active, but he's active in faith. Here he's active in a sort of faithlessness. He knows that God has promised that there's going to be offspring. Those offspring, therefore, must be through Sarah. So he's worried then that if he's killed, that will destroy God's plans. But that is not really thinking about God's sovereignty in this issue. But that's what he says. Then they'll kill me, but will let you live. So he goes on, he says, say you are my sister, that it may go well with you, with me because of you, that my life may be spared for your sake. There's a very great portion of selfishness there. I suppose Abraham wants to protect himself for the future generations. But what about his wife? What about her honour? I suppose he's saying that she'd be spared. But what about her honour? And, you know, if she had conceived by being taken as someone's concubine, what would that do to the promise of God? At the moment, you know, it seems as if Sarah is barren, and we know that she is barren at this point. We know that, but what other medical evidence would they have for that? It could easily have been Abraham who was the problem. Now, of course, as we find out later, Abraham was not the problem. He was fertile. So he gave birth, Hagar gave birth to Ishmael through him, but at this stage, we don't know that. Okay, so he's telling a half-truth as well, because remember, it wasn't wrong for him to marry a half-sister at this stage. That's, that doesn't get forbidden until the time of Moses, and that's because mutations have developed far more. There's not a genetic problem here, so God has not forbidden close intermarriage. And of course, she was his half-sister. They had the same father, Terah, but different mothers. So he's saying, say you're my sister, which is a half-truth, half-lie, but many of the most powerful lies are half-truths. It may go well with me because of you, that my life may be spared for your sake. When Abraham entered Egypt, the Egyptians saw that the woman was very beautiful, which is what Abraham anticipated. When the princes of Pharaoh saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh. Now, this is not what Abraham anticipated. He was anticipating Sarah being taken away by one of the princes, if you like, one of the people of Egypt. But instead, she's praised to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. So she's taken away into Pharaoh's house. Now she's become, therefore, or Pharaoh wishes to make her a concubine. Now, of course, she's kept safe through that. But this is what could have happened. It could have happened that she would have become his concubine. And it says, for her sake, he dealt well with Abraham. Pharaoh dealt well with Abraham. Abraham had sheep. So he had sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male servants, female servants. Pause there, underline that one. Female servants, female donkeys, and camels. All these things have been given to Abraham. And, you know, again, it's a bit odd, isn't it? His wife has been taken away, and he's got all this plunder, if you like. He's being dealt well with. I wonder what he was thinking when this is going on. What's happening to Sarah? Well, I don't know how long Sarah was in Pharaoh's house, but long enough for plagues to have developed. And in Genesis 12, verse 17, the Lord afflicted Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. Now, again, circumstances are different to the next sojourn in Egypt, which is much longer. But again, we had plagues there, and a later Pharaoh wasn't listening to the plagues because his heart was hardened. We're at a stage here where even pagan people like Pharaoh have some acknowledgement of God. We'll see that again later on with Abimelech. Here, Pharaoh is and his household have been have got great plagues because of Sarah, Abraham's wife, and those plagues indicate to Pharaoh that there is something wrong, that and therefore he comes back to Abraham because he realizes that there's something happening here at this point. Now, when he gets back to Abraham, he says, "What is this that you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife?" Now, how did Pharaoh figure that out? Presumably, God is speaking to Pharaoh through these plagues, and Pharaoh listens. The Lord afflicted Pharaoh. We have to assume then that Pharaoh knew that it was the Lord, the true God, who had afflicted him. And he's revealed to him that Sarah is Abraham's wife. Why is this that you've, what is this you've done to me? Why did you not tell me she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister, so that I took her for my wife? Now then, here is your wife, take her and go. When we get this sin repeated, it's a different situation, because God makes Abimelech an ally of Abraham. Here, Abraham is expelled from the land. He's expelled from the land. And it's a humiliation. Abraham has gone seeking food. He's got a lot of plenty, okay? So God has protected him from that point of view. He's given him the plenty, but there is also a stain on his character. It's an embarrassment. It's a severe stain. And there are sins that many of us have done that put a stain on the character. There are people who know of things that I've got wrong in the past. And, you know, I make pronouncements on things on the Bible and so on. And the thing is, if I had to wait till I was perfect and got everything right, I would keep quiet. Maybe some people think I should keep quiet, but that's not the case, because what I'm trying to say so often is what God says, and I'm speaking to myself. So I'm speaking to myself here. There are plenty of sins that have occurred that would be an embarrassment, and it's not right. I shouldn't do them. They shouldn't happen, but they are an embarrassment. Nevertheless, God is never an embarrassment. So Pharaoh gave men orders concerning Abraham, and they sent him away with his wife and all he had. So all the things that Abraham had been given before, the sheep, the oxen, the male donkeys, the male servants, the female donkeys and camels, all those things Abraham gets to keep. We can assume then that, you know, some of those can be used for meat. There's also I would imagine there'd be other plunder as well. But he's not going to have famine, but he's got to leave Egypt. And in the next chapter, he's going to be back in Israel. Or rather Canaan, the land that was going to become Israel. He's back in that land again. So it's important to understand that God has used this event. God has decreed this event. God has used it to save Abraham and his wife Sarah from famine. But in the process, Abraham has committed a sin, a lie, which has put a stain on the character, which will cause a problem later on. And note, there's a huge problem here that has arisen. It's easy to pass this by. Abraham has servants from Egypt. Now, these are not saved souls like the people he brought from Haran, you know, including Eliezer and so on, a man of great faithfulness, particularly if I think that the servant that he sent to get a wife for Isaac was Eliezer. It doesn't say so in Scripture, and I can't totally build a theology on that, okay? Whoever that man, that servant was, he was a faithful servant, but he knew the way to the city of Nahor, which was presumably Haran. He knew that way, and it's possible, therefore, that he was familiar because he was Eliezer and he'd come from there. I think that's a very strong possibility. But we'd read earlier that there were souls brought from Haran. These are people who are faithful. They're with Abraham because they've listened to Abraham about that, and they've come to know the true God. They're no longer pagans. They've come to know the true God. But here we have people. We've got animals there, of course, sheep and oxen for food, donkeys, male and female donkeys for transport, and camels. But also we've got male servants and female servants. And it's interesting that they are divided, the male donkeys and female donkeys, I suppose, are divided so that you can, because the male donkeys are going to be the ones that are most able to do heavy work. But male servants and female servants, we've got to emphasize that there were female servants. Why? Because there's a later mistake, a later sin of both Abraham and Sarah, where they decide again to do God's will. This was really a matter of trying to do God's work for him, protecting themselves in Egypt against famine and against just trying to protect themselves in a way that they had no right to do. But also, there's this later issue that Sarah eventually says, you know, you can continue the line using my maidservant, Hagar. Now, Hagar was an Egyptian maidservant. How did they get Hagar? Where did Hagar come from? This is important. Hagar did not come from Haran, because Hagar is Egyptian. Hagar came from Egypt. And if they hadn't committed this sin of going to Egypt and all the various stuff, you know, Abraham being looked after well because his young, beautiful wife has been taken into the Pharaoh's harem. If that hadn't happened, then Hagar would not have been part of the entourage, and there wouldn't have been the temptation later. Now, of course, God blesses all these things, and God blessed Hagar and so on, but we need to understand where she came from, and that this has huge consequences for later on. So there's a lot there to find out in that second half of chapter 12. It's not incidental. It's not an aberration in that sense. It's all part of God working out his plans and his prophecies. This short sojourn of Abraham in Egypt is typical of the longer sojourn in Egypt that Israel are going to have. Israel being called out of Egypt during the Exodus is, of course, very much like us being called out of the world. It's very much a type of the second coming, because you've got all those plagues there, and you've got a plague here, which is you've got these plagues here as well. So again, this is a mini Exodus on a small scale that has that is prophetic of the later Exodus, that even though this was caused by a sin on Abram's part, God is using it to show what's going to happen later, and there is a pattern being laid down that is repeated over and over again throughout Scripture. God's people being called out of Egypt. I remember one gospel singer in England in the early 1980s performing a song called I don't want to go back to Egypt. I want to live in the promised land. And that should be our idea as Christians. We're not going back to Egypt. Egypt can be used figuratively in that sense. We do not want to go back to that. And yet so many of us as Christians actually do want to go back to Egypt. But we need to be aware that that is not where we should be, because our home is in the promised land. Well, thank you for listening to this podcast. Once again, if you find this podcast a blessing and other podcasts that I do, then please subscribe to me at subscribestar.com/Paul F. Taylor. I'd find that very useful if you can do that. For now, thank you for listening to this podcast, and I'll catch you again, God willing, next week, next Tuesday, on the next episode of the Proverbs 18:10 podcast. Thank you for listening.